Welcome to the Audio Spells production of Journeys of the Astral Path's Michael. I'm Robin, and we are ecstatic to bring you this show. Please help us grow by subscribing, 5-star reviews, liking, sharing, and commenting wherever you enjoy your podcasts. For more information and our full credits, please visit www.theastralpaths.com or search Journeys of the Astral Paths on Facebook. And now, let us cast you a spell.
Morning. I laid my head down for a second and fell fast asleep. Too much wine. Switching to coffee now, and some orange juice. Astropaths love a nice fruit drink after projecting. Projecting is an energy drain and also dehydrating as hell. And without a doubt, the first thing you need is a bit of sugar and any liquid you can grab. After a long journey, like a poker night in Macau, I'll chug a gallon of water and a quart of orange juice just to refill and refuel. Astral projection. You may be wondering what I mean by this. There are many human stories out there, and some tales of fiction that go beyond our abilities. So let me explain what astropaths do when we astral project. I'll return to my sister's story. It's essential to all of this. But so is this ability. So projecting is an ability, how long you can stay out is a skill. With meditation, you learn how to generate energy, chi, so that you can maintain the concentration needed to stay out of your body. This training has been copied by Qigong and other kung fu training, which has been around for thousands of years. But what this does for us and what it can do for a human is like comparing a AAA battery and a nuclear reactor. At first, I was lucky to stay out 5 or 10 minutes. Now, I can stay out of my body for 5 or 6 hours without waning. Marlowe, he stayed out double that, but he spends too much time meditating, building his chi. He can travel anywhere and stay out as long as he wants, practically. So how is it done? I relax my mind. Oh, wait. Fundamentals. I put my body in a location that is safe. Very safe, in fact. You see, while I'm traveling, the body I leave is absolutely vulnerable. If you saw me, you'd assume I was in a coma or dead. And my senses are completely removed, so I wouldn't sense anything, which means I'm helpless. So Marlowe, my teacher, taught me to never travel until your body is in a safe place. I have money, so I built a safe room. A panic room is the term. And I spin the locks of that room, and a machine gun couldn't penetrate it. So within my safe chamber, I relax my mind. I feel my body, the energy pulsing within, this sheer vibrancy. And then I begin the visualization. I must see the place I'm going, see its details, its uniqueness. And as my memory is eidetic, memory or photographic, as they call it sometimes, I do see not just the topography, but the foliage or the buildings or, well, everything. Then I breathe, and then I'm there. Oh, the places I go. I have hundreds of regular spots I visit. My bread place in Paris, my hiking spot in the Swiss Alps, Tibet, the islands of Tiree in Scotland, my favorite vineyard in Chile, and oh, the people. My masseuse in Thailand, my fishing guide, Gunnar, in Iceland, my shinjitsu instructor, Satoshi, in Hiroshima, my Kali knife fighting instructor in the Philippines, Ray, and of course, all the astropaths' homes. Sometimes a kindred spirit feels like home. The journeying life can be lonely, and there is work. I travel for that as well, usually Vegas or Macau, but occasionally I mix it up. Yeah, what other job would a mind reader have than poker player? Come on, it's a hell of an advantage, and I see it as people come to lose their money, and I come to take it. Okay, so Cassandra, maybe I'm rambling because the next part is hard, but here's what happened to my beautiful sister. The first time that I found her, I'd collapsed in the corridor of the hospital. When I was revived, I was yanked away from the backyard of our youth as if I were a balloon being batted up out of the hands of a child and pushed up into the jet stream. I could see her reaching out to me. In a blink of an eye, I was gone, back in my body and awake, groggily pleading with the doctor and nurse to let me go back. Luckily, I had fallen hard enough in the corridor that I had struck my head on the linoleum floor, and I had a welt on my forehead that looked hideous enough they loaded my new IV drip with all kinds of sleepy drugs. Before I'd relax, I insisted they tell me about my sister. Was she alive? Where was she? Reluctantly, the doctor told me, assuming my meds were about to kick in. Your sister was seriously hurt in the crash. She's in a coma in the ICU. Just before I went under again, I kept concentrating on the backyard of my youth and on my sister's pleading expression. And I returned to her. Michael, she asked, why can't I leave here? You come and go, and I try to step in the back door or out the back gate, and I just end up right back here. I didn't know what to say. They say you're in a coma, I said, telling her the truth, or the truth that I knew. What? A coma? How? Why? She asked. The crash. Crash? She repeated this several times. Crash? Crash. I hear this sound. It rolls overhead like a summer storm. Like the one Mom yelled at us for watching in the fort. Remember that? We were soaking wet. That fort could never hold water. She yelled so loud and Dad laughed so hard at us. Wet, muddy rag dolls, he called us. I hear that thunder, but your laughs are cries. You cry my name, it's... Her words stopped, and she looked like a child who couldn't think of the word, and then a child who realized they didn't know the word. I feel the crash, but I don't remember it, she said. I told her, I remember it all too well. It's like I saw it on rerun about 1,000 times. You saved my life, sis. You saved my life. You stopped me from bleeding to death. My wrist was slashed, and you wrapped your shirt around it and slowed my bleeding so I could live. I don't even think you were conscious. It was some sort of reflex, or I don't know, but it worked. Cassandra's face, even in all this confusion, frustration, and horror, lifted into a smile. But I couldn't save you. You're really hurt, I complained. Mikey, she whispered, stop seeing the negative and see the miracles. You and I are a miracle. Our life has been filled with garbage, and yet here we are. You're alive, and somehow you're here with me now. We are. Suddenly, I was ripped away from her. The words gone. I tried to make them out, but instead, I got nothing but bright light and a nurse, stern voice telling me it was time to wake up. I was crying as her face came into focus. She was too young to be so stern and serious. So the bad part about having a possible concussion is they wake you up every few hours to check on you. I pushed myself up into a sitting position in the bed, my mind racing. What was Cassandra saying? How do I get back to her? How do I help her? And who the hell is this guy? Sitting next to my bed, craning his long neck around to force a smile at me, was Dr. Marlo Pogonius. "You have a visitor," the nurse said. Then she looked at him and said, "He needs rest, so keep it short." Man, she was tough, for being fresh out of nursing school. "Michael, I'm about to change your life," Marlo began. "I know you're confused and scared right now, but I assure you I am a friend." I don't know if it was his smooth professor's voice or just how much I needed a friend, but I felt a sense of relief looking up into the blue-gray eyes that lurked behind a pair of circled glasses that rested oddly on his beakish nose. And then he said something that really shocked me. He said, "Cassandra can't find her way out of that yard because she's still alive."